Even just thinking about Easter coming this week and the powerful reminder that is of what it is we celebrate in this Holy Week, as it's commonly called. As we remember today, Palm Sunday, where Jesus came riding into Jerusalem on a donkey. And yet, that was just the start of a march to the cross. The cross wasn't the end of the story, right? He raised again. So I love that powerful reminder as we enter this week, as we get ready to even celebrate Easter next week together. And I want to make sure you're aware of a few ways you can participate with us in celebrating Easter. One of those would be as simple as inviting some people in your life to join us to worship next week. There are like little invite cards out on tables out here, and there's also some digital ones as well. Any of those you don't take, I'm sending to school with Colin right here. So please grab a few. He doesn't want to take all of those. So you guys can help Colin out in that way. Additionally, there are a couple of other things as well. This Friday is Good Friday, and we're going to have a Good Friday experience for you to walk through that'll be self-guided. That'll take place anywhere between 6 a.m. and 7 p.m. You're free to come all 13 hours, or you could come for like 30 minutes to 45 minutes, somewhere in that time frame. It's something you can do on your own, something you can do with your family, something you could do with your small group. We just want to encourage you to participate this Good Friday, to really set your mind and your heart on what it is that Christ did on Good Friday. Additionally, just to maybe even be a guide throughout this week, we've got some Easter blocks that are still available. This is designed to be a little bit more of an experiential thing that has some blocks, a candle for you to participate in this week, and then a devotional guide each week. If you were like maybe thinking, I meant to get that, I meant to order one of those, we still have a bunch of those available. So you can actually get one of those at either the Connection Center or back at the kids' check-in desk. Either place, those are still available. So if you are interested in those, you can grab those. And then finally, this series is I'm Most Like Jesus When. And if you guys remember the very first week, what I heard Phil say was, I am most like Jesus when I serve in kids ministry. Okay? I don't know if that's a situation, if he said I heard or what, but there are still plenty of chances for you to serve both with our kids and our guest services. And if you're thinking, I'm sure someone else will fill that spot in kids ministry, I just want to let you know, I think we've contacted everyone that served in the last 2 years, and there's still some open spots for you to have the joy of spending time with our kids. We're not going to like lock you as a lone adult into a room with 20 kids and then lock the door and say, see you in an hour. And you can be part of making sure someone else doesn't end up in that place. We've got all the resources you'll need, and we'd love for this to make both a good experience for our leaders engaging with our youngest worshipers here, as well as for our kids. So you can participate in any of those ways with us this week as we enter into this Easter week, this Holy Week. Now, as we approach Easter, I think as a parent, I've maybe been more aware of the number of choices that can be involved in what you do or don't do at Easter time. Like, there's the question of, like, do we do the matching outfits or not? How important is a family picture on Easter? And one of my older sisters, Sarah, is here. She could give you, like, personal testimony to Andrew Bondurant's personal feeling on both matching outfits and family pictures. Pictures. There are plenty of pictures that show me just disdaining the thought that someone would make me wear a matching outfit and smile for a picture. So there's plenty of receipts there that show that that's not quite Andrew's idea. So those choices are a little easier. There's also the choices around what do you do with the Easter bunny, Easter baskets, gifts, all of those fun things. There's also the choice, if you're married, like, Whose traditions do you carry over? You know, do you carry yours or your spouse's? For me, is it Bree's families that we do, or do we do the right ones? Do we do what the Bondurant family always did, right? You've got all these different choices that have to be made when you enter this season. But the reality for us is that it should be kind of normal for us whenever it comes to making choices. Like, that's something we should be used to. Someone just this last week shared with me that we make 35,000 choices each and every day. And I don't know how exactly you calculate that, but I'll tell you, even if you like say they were off by 50%, like 17,500 decisions a day, that's a lot. Or let's say they're off by 90%. 3,500 decisions a day, that's a lot of choices to be made day in and day out, right? As we think about the choices we make each and every day, most of us like to think that our choices are based on what the most rational, most wise option is given the choice set before us. But that doesn't really match reality. The reality is that each of us make decisions, and a large part of the decisions we make are longings that we have within ourselves that we may or may not be aware of. There are longings within us that are vying for our attention as we try to make decisions each and every day. And these longings aren't bad in and of themselves. In fact, God made us to be people who have longings and who even have longings that impact our decision making. The issue is that oftentimes in our world today, we have a hard time sorting between our strongest or maybe most immediate desires and our deepest and truest desires. So on this side, you have strong, immediate desires. This side, you've got deeper and truest desires. And a really surface-level way to see this would be to look at Andrew Bonner whenever I come into church each Sunday. I have a strong and immediate longing to consume somewhere between 1 and 4 donuts on a given Sunday morning. But the thing that I find is that as I give in to maybe that strong or immediate longing, I'm left longing for more. It doesn't actually satisfy my deeper or truer longing, which is the reality that my body has a deep and a true longing for nutrition, right? Which isn't exactly met with these donuts that I like to consume. But that sort of the struggle there between strong and immediate desires or longings, and then you've got those deep and true longings, those aren't things that just apply to things like food. It's much deeper than that. And it's something that we actually see Jesus himself wrestle through in his own life. If you look at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, right before he starts his ministry, he goes out into the wilderness and he fasts for 40 days, goes without food for 40 days. And then Matthew has just a brilliant way of exposing the obvious by saying, and then he was hungry. It's like, yeah, I think after 40 days you get hungry, right? And what you see is Satan comes to Jesus and says, if you are the Son of God, then make this stone bread. That would hit Jesus' strong and immediate desire, right? This desire for bread, this desire for food, this desire for substance. And that is a good desire or a good longing that Jesus had. The problem was that Satan was trying to get Jesus to give into this strong and immediate desire in a way that would actually betray his deeper or truer longing to glorify his Father. Jesus had a deeper or a truer longing that was actually more true about him, and he was able to navigate that in a way that sometimes I think we struggle with. But that's not the last time Jesus faced this. Just a couple weeks ago, we look at Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane as he's getting ready to go to the cross, and we see him even just pleading with his Father, God, if there's any other way, take this cup of suffering from me. He has a strong and an immediate longing to not face the suffering that the cross would bring. And yet he had a deeper and a truer longing to glorify his Father, to complete the work that he was set here to complete. And Jesus was able to experience the satisfaction of that deeper and truer longing instead of pressing into what seemed more immediate. I think this is where the disconnect comes in for a lot of us. I mean, we live in a world, in a culture that tells us that fulfilling our most strong or immediate longings is something that we have to do. Self-fulfillment is just core to who we are. We have to satisfy these immediate, strong longings that we have, or we might miss out on being who God made us to be. That's not the case. I just saw a study just from this last month that showed that 91% of Americans would say that self-fulfillment is a core value of what it means to be an American. So whenever we see self-fulfillment put on a pedestal, and then we see the life of Jesus and even the way that his life ended, we can be left with a little bit of confusion. Which is it? What should guide our life? What should guide our choices if our longings truly do influence those things? I think if we're honest, there's often very little about Jesus' death and even some of his life that seems very appealing to us. So if you have your Bible, I'm going to invite you to turn to Matthew chapter 27 with me. Matthew chapter 27, we are going to look at Jesus as he goes to endure the cross. And as you're turning there, I want to offer a grossly oversimplified summary of Jesus' life. Jesus spent 30 plus years living in obscurity as a craftsman, where we have absolutely zero record of anything that Jesus made or built during those 30 years. He then spent just over 3 years in ministry, which resulted in a public death designed not only to shame him, but anyone who would associate with him. Throughout his life, he had moments where the crowds were intrigued, but they left disappointed because while Jesus had a platform, while Jesus had been given a platform with the world around him, he didn't use that to advance his political agenda or even some religious agenda in a sense. Instead, he used this in a very different way, which again, just doesn't make sense in our world today. We're told if you have a platform, you need to use that to build yourself up in an even greater way. And yet we see something different in Jesus, which causes a disconnect for us. He was supposedly the Messiah, the anointed one that God had promised to send. And yet, how could it be that this is who he was in light of what we're about to see in Matthew chapter 27? If you look at Matthew chapter 27, verse 28, you see that Jesus is stripped in that moment. That they put a scarlet robe on him. They begin mocking Jesus in this moment. Again, if Jesus really is a king, if he really is this Messiah that's been sent, then he's got to have a robe, right? He's got to have his royal robe, his scarlet robe. And then in verse 29, we see that they twist together a crown of thorns and press it on his head as his crown. Again, mocking him as king. After this, they put a staff in his right hand, which serves as sort of like a little royal scepter that they give Jesus to have on this day. And then they mock him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." After this, they spit on him. But they don't just spit on him. They take that royal scepter, that staff that they had given him, and they begin to beat him with them. Again, mocking the idea that he could possibly be the king that some people were claiming. And then in verse 31, we see that they again mocked him. They took the robe off. They put his own clothes on, and they led him away to be crucified. We saw last week that Jesus had been sentenced to this death, and now we see he is marching that direction, and people are mocking him because it doesn't seem possible that this could be the way that the life of a king would end. We see in verse 37 that they put a sign over his head that was the written charge against him, which said, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Again, this isn't a declaration of their belief in Jesus as king. This is them mocking the thought that a king would possibly go through something like this. We see Jesus walk through this. And again, I think there can be a disconnect thinking, how does this apply to my life? The mocking continues in verses 39 through 40. It says, "Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, 'You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself, come down from the cross if you are the Son of God.'" Again, this is a moment where Jesus is tempted to give in to a strong and an immediate longing, right? To actually come down from the cross in that moment. We see Matthew create even a parallel back to Matthew chapter 4 when Jesus is tempted in the wilderness. When Jesus is in the wilderness, what Satan says is, "If you are the Son of God, turn this stone to bread. If you are the Son of God, do this." And then what do the crowd say right there in verse 40? "If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." You can't be a king if this is the way that your life is ending. We pick things up in verse 42 as we see this shame just being cast upon Jesus. The crowds again mock him, saying, he saved others, but he can't save himself. He's the king of Israel. Let him come down from the cross and we'll believe in him and trust. He trusts God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, I am the Son of God. In the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. If Jesus really was one that was saving others, why doesn't he save himself in this moment? And then in verse 50, we see Matthew highlight that Jesus still had agency in this moment. He was still active in this process. He wasn't just passive in what was happening. It says this, and when Jesus cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. Matthew chose an odd way to say that Jesus died, but what he's doing is he's pointing back to what Jesus had said earlier when Jesus said, no one takes my life from me. Instead, I lay it down. But if Jesus truly did have agency in this moment, why is it that he chose to still endure the cross? When we see Jesus using this kind of power, this kind of authority in this way, I think it leaves us scratching our heads, asking the question, how is it that we are to live like Jesus in light of this death? What does it mean for me to live in this way? Why would such a life even be compelling? How could such a life possibly lead to satisfaction of my true and deep longings that I have? What could we possibly learn from Jesus' life in this moment that would influence how we live this time tomorrow, whether that means you're at school or you're at home or you're at a workplace or wherever it is that you will be? How does Jesus' life that ends in public shaming and death influence how you and I pursue the satisfaction of the longings we have in our own lives? I mentioned earlier that my longings and your longings are often set on having them satisfied with the most immediate or strongest longing that we have that pops up in front of us. And this is what sin has done to those good longings that God has given us. We see this in the very beginning happen with Adam and Eve. God created an Adam and Eve, and he said that they were created in his likeness, in his image. And then Satan comes along, and what does Satan say? You will be like God if you do this. Satan immediately calls into question the fact that God had created Adam and Eve to experience satisfaction in God. Instead, what he says is, no, God is holding something back from you. And he taps into this strong and immediate desire to be like God. And in that moment, Adam and Eve forfeit that deep satisfaction that they have, that deep longing of fellowship with God. It actually turns their longings in towards themselves instead of looking beyond themselves for satisfaction. This is what sin does to us. Sin turns us inward. In fact, if you look at our world tells us that self-fulfillment or self-satisfaction is exactly what you should run after, no matter what the cost is. In fact, you are depriving yourself if you don't run after self-fulfillment or self-satisfaction. Look inside, and whatever desires, whatever longings you see, you need to fulfill those. Or you're just depriving yourself. You're missing out on satisfaction. I think Jesus offers us a better way. If you're joining us in our Bible reading plan as we go through the Bible in a year with the Bible Project, and recently you probably made it through the book of Judges, which ends with the culmination of what it looks like when a people or a culture live this way, when they run after self-fulfillment or self-satisfaction, no matter what the cost is. Judges chapter 20, verse 25, or 21, verse 25 says this: in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. This is the culmination of a people that run after self-satisfaction or self-fulfillment in a way that's unchecked by anything else
in their lives. They run after these distorted longings without any attention to the fact that there may be something deeper that they're missing out on. A people driven by the belief that they must fulfill their most immediate and strongest desires as they show themselves. But does that sound familiar, maybe? I'm not just talking about looking around at our world today. I'm talking about looking in at our own hearts. Do you notice that own tendency in your heart? To just fulfill whatever's most immediate, whatever that strongest desire is, and maybe missing out on something greater. Maybe you found yourself in a pattern where you keep trying to satisfy that immediate longing that you have, but you find yourself afterwards still longing for more. Again, I think Jesus offers us something better. Our longing for satisfaction is a good, God-given desire. The question is, how does the life and death of Jesus define how we as people live with these deep longings? As we explore this question, as we keep Matthew chapter 27, his death in our purview, I want us to take a few minutes just to look at how the people around Jesus, how the world around Jesus received his march towards the cross. And how that might confront or even challenge us as we make decisions day in and day out. Maybe even as we check what our deep longings are in our life. You see, if you start in the book of Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, Matthew doesn't leave it up to us to guess who he thinks Jesus is. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1 says this, "This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God, the Son of Abraham." The people of Israel had been waiting and longing for a Messiah to come for centuries. And if we're wondering who a Messiah is, well, the Messiah was an anointed leader that God would send to rescue his people. The Jews in the first century longed for someone that would come and overthrow the Romans, that would give them political freedom. That beyond that political freedom would even just bring back the dynasty of King David, who was someone who was thought highly of in their culture. They were waiting for David's kingly line to be restored. This would mean the freedom and the thriving of the country of Israel as they used to have in David's day. This is what they were expecting from the Messiah. And as Matthew goes on to show us a picture of Jesus' life and ministry, you see the expectation or the longing of the people thinking maybe it's Jesus. It seems to start bubbling up. In Matthew chapter 5 through 7, you see what's commonly called the Sermon on the Mount. And the Sermon on the Mount concludes in Matthew chapter 7, verses 28 and 29, with the people being amazed at the teaching of Jesus because Jesus taught as one with authority. And this picture of Jesus' authority, Jesus' power, is something that, again, gets people pretty excited. But Matthew doesn't stop there. As he gets into Matthew chapter 8, we see him show Jesus' power over sickness, Jesus' power over nature, Jesus' power over the demonic, over the spiritual realm. You get into Matthew chapter 9 and you even see that Jesus has the power to forgive sin. Jesus' power and authority continues to be put on display throughout the book of Matthew. But who Jesus is as he is exercising this power and authority just catches the people of Israel off guard. It's not satisfying that strong and immediate desire they have to be set free from the Roman people. And here is where we begin to see maybe the answer to our question earlier. How does the life and death of Jesus define how we live as people with deep longings? You see, the use of power and authority in our world is too often built on or driven by those corrupt longings that have been turned inward. We can see this by how power is maybe used by other people in our world or in our culture, or again, we can probably look in our own hearts and see hints of this as well, where we're tempted to use the things we have to satisfy ourselves, not thinking about anyone else in the world, but only how this impacts me. It leads to some sort of self-fulfillment, pursuit of self-fulfillment, or pursuit of self-promotion. We think we've got to always build ourselves up, or we'll never be seen, or it leads to self-centered consumption, where we begin to consume things or even people around us in a way where we're just looking at the world saying, what do you have to offer me? This is what sin has done to these good longings. And yet we see in Jesus a different way of using power and authority. And I believe we see it done in such a way that actually brings the true satisfaction that each of us longs for. Let's look at Matthew chapter 16 as Jesus' identity is beginning to be come to the surface in the book of Matthew. And not only his identity, but the implications of who he is as well. Matthew chapter 16 verses 13 through 16 says this: when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets." The Son of Man is a common way that Jesus refers to himself, and it's picking up on some language from the Old Testament. It was a title from the Old Testament, but it wasn't altogether clear how the Son of Man related to the Messiah, and we see this sort of in the response that they give about what people were saying about Jesus. They were saying, well, some people say you're like Elijah, Jeremiah, but they think he's more of just a prophet. After this, Jesus becomes pretty direct in his question to his disciples. He says, "But what about you? Who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Jesus affirms this declaration that Peter gives. And then in verse 20, he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Now, there's a whole lot we could get at in this passage, but I want us to focus in on this idea of Messiah, because Jesus affirmed Peter's declaration that Jesus was the Messiah, but then he told him not to tell anyone else. Why would that be? Why would Jesus not want this message shared more broadly? Well, it was because there was still a misunderstanding of what it meant for Jesus to be Messiah. The people of Israel, again, they longed for this Messiah. And Jesus' disciples were all people of Israel. They all longed for a Messiah, but it didn't seem like Jesus was going to deliver on what they hoped to see. Crowds came and went, but Jesus wasn't using this power and authority that he had clearly showed to overthrow the Romans. He wasn't using this power and authority that he had showed like the people around him or the world around him would use power. Even Jesus' disciples, again, still thought that he would use this role in this clear exercise of power and authority to go out and deliver the people of Israel from this political reign. And that was what they had set their hope and their longing on. If that happened, then they would be satisfied. They longed for freedom. And this helps explain what we see here in the next few verses. Verses 21 through 23, it says, "From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. 'Never, Lord,' he said, 'this shall never happen to you.' Jesus turned and said to Peter, 'Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns.'" Verse 21 makes clear that this was a turning point for Jesus and his ministry as he sets his focus on the coming suffering and the coming cross. He's preparing his disciples for a new way of thinking, a new way of living, a new way of experiencing satisfaction. But what Jesus pointed to didn't look much like success or satisfaction in the paradigm that the disciples had for what the Messiah would do and who the Messiah would be. We see this in the rebuke of Peter by Jesus. As Jesus says there in verse 23, he says, "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." You see, Jesus was working from a different paradigm. He's working from a different understanding of how the world worked. Well, he taught and showed his authority and displayed his authority over sickness, death, over the spiritual realm, over nature, and even over sin. As he forgave sin, he said that he himself would suffer many things and ultimately be killed. Peter found this unbelievable. This couldn't be what was coming for the Messiah. Peter and the people of Israel both were longing for something different, and yet Jesus showed that there's a new paradigm for us to offer from that actually brings true and lasting satisfaction. Jesus showed that there's a different way of living in this world in light of the reign that he would establish that wouldn't just be the way for Jesus, but it would be the way for his followers as well. We see this in chapter 16, verses 24 through 26. It says, "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the entire world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul?' Those who desire to save their lives must lose it." It's such a backwards way of thinking. And yet Jesus says that they will find the life that they're looking for. They will actually find the salvation they're looking for when they lose their life. And here's where I think we see the tension between Jesus' teaching and our lives begin to be resolved. The way of Jesus requires a willingness to set aside our lives and the behaviors that maybe we've established for how we live day in and day out to actually experience true life in him. The way of Jesus demands a different understanding of what it is that brings true and lasting satisfaction. It's not just satisfying every strong and immediate desire that comes in, but it's trusting that God will meet our deeper desires. Even if we don't know what those desires are yet, it's trusting him to bring that about in our lives. The way of Jesus isn't just something we add to our lives. Instead, it's something that changes how we define everything about our lives. And Jesus didn't just teach this. He lived it. Again, we saw this in Matthew chapter 27 as we see him endure the mocking that came as he went and died the death on the cross that you and I deserve so that we could experience new life in him. We see Jesus walk this path that he's inviting into us. You see, rather than Jesus' death being an interruption to Jesus being the Messiah, it actually served as his enthronement ceremony and in a way gave us a picture of where true life is found. Jesus' death is both the means by which and the example of what it looks like for you and I to live the life we were created for. It is only in and through his death that you and I can have our corrupted desires by sin healed and forgiven and experience the true and lasting deep satisfaction we are longing for. And the way of Jesus is the way of the cross. And the way of Jesus isn't just the way of Jesus, it's the way of his followers as well. So how does that impact how we live? Well, I think that Jesus' death reveals that the deep longings you and I have are satisfied in very different ways than we might believe. You see, the way of Jesus calls for self-emptying over self-fulfillment. Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 7 is a moment where the apostle Paul is talking to the church at Philippi about the reality of what Christ's death, what Christ even becoming man means for us. And he says, "In your relationship with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who, being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God as something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness." You see, when you and I pursue self-fulfillment, it may be evidence that we don't believe that God can actually satisfy the deep longings that we have.
may be evidence that we think that if we're going to actually experience lasting satisfaction in this life, we have to bring that about. And yet, as we look at Jesus' life, as we look at his self-emptying love on the cross, we see that he makes a way for us to experience the deep satisfaction we were created for by having our relationship with God healed, by giving his life in a way that was self-emptying, not taking advantage of the rights and authorities that he had, but actually emptying himself of those so that you and I could experience a new relationship with God. That's the means by which we experience this. But it doesn't stop there. It also provides an example and evidence that emptying ourselves for others is the way of living the life you and I were created for. It can mend broken relationships. It can actually bring about alignment as we run after God's mission with other people. It can bring about a sense of power and authority being seen in our world in a way that doesn't make sense, because it's actually the hidden hand of God moving it, not our pursuit or our grasping in and of our own power. And rather than focusing on our own fulfillment or our own satisfaction, what we find is that our deep longings are actually satisfied when we live according to our Creator's design. He actually gives us a better way. Secondly, the way of Jesus calls for self-denial over self-promotion. Again, Philippians chapter 2, verse 8 says, "And being found in the appearance of a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross." When we pursue self-promotion, it can be evidence that we don't actually believe that God sees us. Or that maybe if God sees us, that he doesn't really like what he sees. But the way of Jesus, pressing in to self-denial, his self-denying love that Jesus displayed as he chose obedience over comfort, is displayed in the extent of his obedience by actually going to the cross so that you and I could experience new life in him. And it resulted in Jesus being exalted. But it doesn't just stop there. It's not just something that he did for us to give us a new life. It also provides an example that God truly does oppose the proud while exalting the humble. And as we press into self-denial, we experience the true satisfaction as God lifts us up. And even if this lifting up that we experience isn't something that's seen by others, it's confirmation that our Father sees us. And being seen by our Father is enough. Finally, a third thing I think we see in the death of Jesus that impacts how we live day in and day out is that the way of Jesus calls for others-focused generosity over self-centered consumption. That was the wordiest way I could come up with what I was trying to say. And I kept it like that because I want you to wrestle through that idea. Others-focused generosity over self-centered consumption. Wrestle through what that looks like in your life. You see, this pursuit of self-centered consumption that many of us are on, it may be evidence, again, that we don't trust that God will actually satisfy our deep desires. That it's something we have to do on our own. It can expose a scarcity mindset that we have, which is this idea that there's only a certain number of goods or certain number of resources in this world. And if I let go of any of it, then I might miss out on what it is that God desires to do. I may miss out on this satisfaction. I've got to hold on to all these things. And it shows that we may not believe that we serve a God of abundance. We serve a God who has more than we could imagine. That satisfaction is found in a very different way. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9 shows this picture of Jesus coming to earth. It says, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that through his poverty he might become rich." This is that deep
and lasting satisfaction that we long for. It came because Jesus rejected self-centered consumption and instead chose to show an others-focused generosity in the giving of his own life for you and me so we can experience the riches of being called a child of God. But it doesn't stop there. It provides an example for us to see that true and lasting satisfaction does not come from you and I grasping on to things. Instead, it comes as we open our hands and we say to God, God, it's all yours. And I trust that you are a God who can satisfy, even if it means me releasing this thing that I think is going to really satisfy me. I'm going to trust that you know better than I do how to satisfy. I'm going to fix my eyes on those you've set around me instead of fixing my eyes on myself and my own satisfaction. It's a way of expressing faith again that God is a God of abundance and a God who will satisfy in ways we can't imagine. Now, as we wrap up, I just trust and believe that God knows each and every one of us in this room. And I think he might have something for each of us to do, but instead of us just figuring that out on our own or me maybe even telling you exactly what that is, I want to provide some space for God to speak to us. So what we're going to do is we're going to take about 90 seconds. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to encourage you to just sit open-handed before the Lord. Say, okay, God, what is it you're inviting me into? Is it self-emptying over self-fulfillment? Is there a way that you're pursuing self-fulfillment in a way that's actually binding you up? Is it self-denial that God's inviting you to take a step into? Is it others-focused generosity? Are there things in your life that you're clinging onto? If you'd simply release, you'd enjoy something that God has that's just going to blow your mind. I'm just going to pray to set this up and then give you some space to hear from God. And I just want you to ask the question, God, what's one thing this week that I can do to take a step in this way? Don't try to do all these things in a moment. Instead, what's the one thing that God is inviting you into? So God, we do ask that you would show us what it is that you're inviting us into. God, are you inviting us to deny ourselves a new way instead of just trying to promote ourselves? Are you inviting us to self-emptying ourselves instead of trying to fulfill ourselves? Or God, is it around generosity? God, we trust you to speak. You show each of us what one step we can take is. In Jesus' name we pray.